The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Strong earnings and positive retail sales helped U.S. stocks to finish their best week in months. Meanwhile, inflation figures continue to edge higher along with oil, food, and industrial commodity prices. Up on deck is Ryan Poplava with this week's wrap-up. Then Bullseye Craig Johnson at Piper Sandler gives us an update on his outlook and says we are amazingly, once again, right on track to hit his year-end target for the S&P 500. Then Dave Morgan comes on to discuss what we're seeing in the precious metals and commodities markets right now. And to round things off, in today's big picture segment, Jim and I talk about the energy crisis making its way to America's shores and again explain the outlook for persistent inflation. But before all that, here's Ryan with today's market wrap.
There is just a lot to unpack here this week, so let's get right into it. I'm going to break up this week's wrap-up into two segments. The first will be about the economic numbers this week and the influence they had with a focus on the price data we got. And the second segment will be about earnings. As a result of those two main catalysts, we have a rebound in stocks, especially in cyclical and growth stocks. Now, that rebound began intraday Wednesday when the consumer price index was up 0.4% in September, above consensus. But core CPI, that excludes energy and food, was up a mild 0.2%. And that right there is what really triggered the market. Year over year, total CPI was up 5.4% and core CPI was a steady 4%. The initial reaction on the data saw the 10-year Treasury hit a high of 1.6% before reversing to finish at 1.55%, but at one point was down 7 basis points, which caused the yield curve to flatten. And it was this reaction that sent the market rallying. And after 3 straight days of losses in stocks, it was a welcome by the bulls who took advantage of it. The bond reaction to a higher producer price index the following day was similar. Thursday, the producer price index for September was announced a bit below expectations, but still up significantly. Month over month, the index was up 0.5%, while core was up only 0.2%. Year over year, the index for final demand was up 8.6% versus 8.3% in August, so up there, and the largest advance on record since 2010. By the end of the day, the 2-year Treasury yield decreased 2 basis points to 0.35%. And the 10-year Treasury yield fell to 1.52% in what traders have coined a peak inflationary sentiment move. I'm a bit cautious calling it that because we heard that same story told this summer, but regardless, the combined reaction in the bond market to these inflationary readings is what sent stocks flying for both value and growth areas. And by the end of the day Thursday, all 11 S&P 500 sectors were up, with materials up 2.4% and consumer discretionary at the low end up 1%. And with that, the S&P 500 was able to close above its 50-day moving average of 44.36 on a closing basis. So all very telling with how the market rebounded this week, all based off of really this idea that inflation may have peaked. Finally, Friday's retail sales report for September helped carry the ball further into the bull zone as consumers bounced back from some of the COVID curtailed activity of August. And sales were up 0.7% month over month, and excluding autos, it was up 0.8%. The reading was interpreted as consumers being resilient in the face of higher energy prices and higher prices overall due to supply chain constraints, which have been persisting. The S&P consumer discretionary sector was the leader of the day on Friday, up 1.53%. Now let's turn to earnings and some company-related news this week. Heading into the start of the earnings season this week, it was expected earnings for the S&P 500 would be up 27.5%, according to FactSet. With 8% of the companies reporting thus far this week, the blended earnings growth rate is up now to 30% as of Friday, according to FactSet. That strength was mainly due to the large amount of financials that posted this week. Now, JP Morgan was a big, a shining beacon in the financial segment with earnings of $3.74 per share, a large beat of 74 cents over the consensus. But the stock unfortunately closed down on the news because of the large reserve release that sort of supercharged the earnings and because of a 2% dip in average loans versus last year. But the company said this area has stabilized and is poised for growth going forward. Now, Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and later on I think Friday, Goldman Sachs, all had great reactions to their earnings. And so let's turn to United Health and Walgreens Boots Alliance, which also had some great responses to their earnings. United Health posted revenue growth of 11% year over year. And the company is seeing strong signups for Medicare Advantage, dual special needs plans, and Medicaid. And the company is seeing people who postponed seeing the doctor during COVID are now seeing their doctor and filing claims a lot more prevalently, which hurt profits in the second quarter, but that has sort of tapered a little bit here in the third quarter, and operating margins have improved. And now, year over year, those operating margins have gone from 4.1% last year to now 4.7% this year. Its benefit manager and care services segment saw revenue jump 13.9% year over year and up 4% over the last quarter. United Health bumped up its full year earnings guidance, up 35 cents at the low end and up 10% at the high end of its range. And again, Goldman Sachs did great on Friday. Alcoa, J.B. Hunt, Transport Services were all up big on their earnings announcements on Friday and ended positively to those announcements. Now, FactSet said if earnings continue at this pace, meaning companies announce and beat as they have this week, we could possibly see the third highest growth rate for the pace of earnings since 2010 for the quarter. Some of the other key news stories this week that I wanted to mention but weren't as big of a mover, except for the negative news that came out of Apple early in the week that it would have to slash its iPhone production target by up to 10 million units due to chip shortages. Delta warned that rising fuel costs could hurt profitability in the fourth quarter, and Moderna got FDA approval for its booster shot for adults over 65. Finally, for the week, the Federal Open Market Committee minutes for September were released and gave some indication of how the Fed may taper its purchases when it does, in fact, make that announcement, possibly at the end of this month. And what they plan to do is reduce purchases by $15 billion a month to end somewhere in the middle of 2022, but the news didn't seem to move the markets all too much. That's it for the heavily packed week in economics and earnings as the market rebounded in a bullish fashion above some really key technical levels. We'll definitely want to hear from our technician this week just how important that level was and where things could go from here. The next week, we'll likely continue to see a focus on earnings with a Fed meeting not for another couple of weeks. That's it for this week's wrap-up.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero-interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, are we heading into that year-end rally with stocks going up this week? Good news for investors. Let's find out if this continues. Joining us on the program is Bullseye Craig Johnson. Craig, at the beginning of the year, the S&P was, what, close to 3,600. You had a target of 4,225. In May, you raised your target to 4,625. We're now at 4,464. Are you still holding to that year-end target?
Thanks, Jim. And absolutely, we're sticking with that year-end price objective. We're about 3.5% roughly away from getting there. I still think that is an achievable goal. It seems like we continue to see the earnings numbers come in. Certainly good indication so far, Jim, with the banks. I think that's going to be an achievable number for sure.
Craig, you know, one of the things that we've seen this year is rapid rotation in the markets. We started out, you know, we had the inflation trade that ended during the summer. We had a pullback in tech. Now tech seems to be doing Okay, energy, which had pulled back during the summer, is now just soaring. What's your take with these rotations, as many as we've had this year?
A good friend of mine, Jim, and you know him well, Ralph Ocampora, has always said that rotation inside the market is the lifeblood of a great bull market. And I think he's right with that statement. And these rotations have been taking place, and it's been alleviating some of those overbought conditions. And when you step back, Jim, and you think about it, just looking at a chart of the NASDAQ 100 or the S&P 500, you'll quickly come to the conclusion that this market is really innocent until proven guilty. I mean, the uptrends are still intact. Yes, we're getting these rotations internally inside of the market, but the popular averages still continue to be above their rising 200-day moving averages. And therefore, as technicians, we're going to follow that trend. We're going to follow that lead. And that's exactly what we've been doing and why we stayed positive on this market with our year-end objective of 46.25, Jim.
Right now, I'm just looking at some of the S&P 500 sectors. And Craig, we've got energy, you know, looks like a NASA space launch if you look at the charts. Technology looks like it's trying to come back. What's your take on the various sectors and what really stands out to you as you look at these 10 sectors?
Well, what stands out to me, so again, we're always overweight three sectors, underweight three sectors. And at the time of the publication that we had put out back in September, we've been overweight basic materials, consumer cyclicals, and financials, and underweight consumer staples, healthcare, and utilities. But I got to tell you, I'm starting to see some more positive trends in technology and clearly positive trends in the energy sector and a little more weakness cropping up in consumer cyclicals and basic materials. And in fact, when I dive a little deeper into that, Jim, if I start looking inside of all of the industry groups that we have here at Piper Sandler, my observation is it's really the energy sector that is really making the 26-week relative strength new highs. And relative strength new highs, along with the financial sector. Those two sectors are dominating the absolute new highs and relative strength new highs list right now. And I think in terms of energy, Jim, I don't see the energy trade necessarily slowing down. In fact, if I just look at a basic chart of crude oil prices, I guess what I would say right now is the trend is sort of setting itself up for perhaps $90 to $100 oil by the time we get to Thanksgiving, Jim. I'm not sure what's going to change it. Seems like the demand side is going up. The supply side still seems to be fairly constrained at this point in time. And I think it's going to take a long time to bring more energy online at this point in time. So I think through the winter heating season, I think people are going to probably be dialing down their thermostats to try to offset much, much higher bills that they're going to see to heat their homes this coming winter.
Craig, do you see this as impacting the economy? I know the GDP numbers are starting to come down for the third quarter and the fourth quarter. And, you know, we've got West Texas Intermediate crude at 81 if it hits to 90. Here in California, we're approaching $5 in Southern California for gasoline. Northern California, they got places that are over $6 right now.
Jim, there's no question that that would have a negative impact to the economy, to consumer spending, all the way across the board. If you look back through history, dramatic prices higher in crude oil have led to recessions and other economic downturns in the past. And I don't see why this would be any different this time around. And from my perspective, Jim, if we look back to where you were in 2007 and 2008, oil prices were closer to $150 a barrel back then.
And here we are, what, $81? And, you know, yourself and others are saying 90 and 100 is a good, distinct possibility.
Absolutely is a very distinct possibility. And the energy stocks, though, Jim, put this into perspective. A lot of portfolio managers don't want to touch the energy stocks right now because of ESG. And I certainly think there are components of ESG that are important. I mean, we all want clean water. We all want clean air. We all live in the same spaceship together, Jim. So I understand those positive components of ESG. The challenge we have right now is trying to balance moving over toward clean energy and moving over toward wind power, solar power, and even other forms of nuclear power. I know that in California, they just closed down one of the nuclear power plants. Seems like a very strange time right now to be closing down nuclear power plants heading into winter months when we're very tight in terms of nat gas supplies and oil prices are moving higher.
It's, you know, it's crazy. That's one of the things that we're seeing in Europe, Craig, is we want to move towards clean energy. But, you know, here in California, we just outlawed gas lawnmowers and leaf blowers. So as we get more towards this clean, green economy, you've got to have electricity. I mean, if we're all driving EVs and they're in the garage at night charging, you're going to need more power sources. I don't know if the grid's strong enough to handle it.
Jim, that's a very valid point. And, you know, another interesting point to make on that, too, is you look at the Public Utility Commission down in Arizona. They actually just lowered their payout to their utility company down there from 10% guaranteed rate of return to like 8.75. You're right. There's going to have to be a ton of infrastructure that's going to have to be modernized. It's going to have to be upgraded. It's going to have to be enhanced. I think one of your best ways to really play the move toward electrification of cars, in your particular case, Jim, lawnmowers and leaf blowers and everything else, is we're going to have more electricity delivered and the grids are going to have to be stronger. And I think the electric utilities is probably one of the best ways to get there. And on top of it, Jim, for those individuals listening here today, I would just say that you're also looking for income for your portfolios. So these utility companies offer very nice dividends. And if you can put together a nice portfolio of electric utilities with staggered payment cycles, you can create a paycheck out of the month, which is a pretty good concept for a lot of individuals looking for income in this low interest rate environment.
And speaking of utilities, what's your take on the utility sector? It pulled back, got down to what, it's 200-day moving average. It looks like it's trying to make an attempt to come back, but you can't have EVs without electricity.
100%. I think what's going on with the utility sector itself is it's been a little bit of a relative laggard, given the fact that we have started to see interest rates move back up again. They haven't necessarily been cheap. But again, if you look at some of these electric utility companies, they've got very good balance sheets. They've got very low dividend payout ratios. And many of these companies have raised dividends every year for about the last 10 years in a row. I mean, if you pull out some of the examples, Jim, if I could, looking at things like UTL or Public Service Group Inc., you know, PEG, or you look at OGE, or you look at Pinnacle West or Xcel here in Minneapolis, or American Electric Power or CMS or Alliant Energy, ticker LNT, or DTE Energy, ticker DTE. These are all companies that have got very nice dividend yields and have very consistently grown their dividends over the last 10 years. But these are going to be on the forefront of the green revolution. These companies are going to have that infrastructure in place because we're not getting rid of the grid. In fact, we're going to become more dependent upon the grid.
You know, I want to come back to energy for a minute. And I'm thinking about as we head towards $90, maybe $100 oil, I'm thinking of what companies will be impacted. So I'm thinking right now, Craig, Amazon. I mean, you know, this idea, you go on Amazon, you click something and it's on your doorstep the next day. You know, all those vans, all those trucks, all those airplanes that are transporting these goods, what's that going to look like when you're talking about $90 and $100 oil?
Well, Jim, take that concept. We can also layer into it too. Every company thinks that, well, we'll just pass the price along. And everybody's trying to pass the price along, whether it's in the restaurant business, whether it's in the Amazon in terms of shipping costs, whether it's FedEx, whether it's American UPS or any of these other companies, they're all just going to simply pass along these higher expenses. Well, the consumer can only take on so much, so many of these higher expenses, Jim, before they've got to start making choices before you start getting destruction of demand. We also have to think about the airlines, too. I mean, number one input for them is going to be fuel costs, and then it's going to be labor costs after that. So the airlines are going to be negatively impacted. And then think about what you're seeing in some of the staples companies, too. They've got to deliver fresh produce. They've got to perhaps deliver those kind of things. And they're going to try to pass those costs along also. So everybody's going to try to pass it along. But on the flip side, who's going to benefit from all these higher prices? I mean, look at places like, you know, Pioneer PXD in terms of some of the drillers, or look at Range Resources. I think they should benefit very well from some of those plays, as just two examples of things we like. And then, Jim, the one thing we haven't touched about, it's call it the dirty part of the energy side of it, but look at these coal companies.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, coal is making 26-week relative strength new highs, and you are also seeing it making 26-week relative strength new highs. Fully understand, coal passes no ESG screens at this point in time, but again, 20% of the electrical generation in this country still comes from coal, whether we like it or not. And I got to tell you, left, right, doesn't matter. Everybody wants their lights to turn on when that light switch gets flipped up. And it doesn't matter, left or right. If those light switch doesn't come on when they want those lights to come on, people are going to be really unhappy. So I would just simply say at this point in time, we're still dependent upon coal in this country, and I'm certainly happy to move away from it over time, but we need to be smart about it. We need to be able to move away from it, but put a reliable source in that will work when the wind doesn't blow, and a reliable source on a cloudy day. Okay. I get that everybody wants to move very quickly into all these other renewables, but it doesn't matter. Left, right, Republican, Democrat, whatever. Lights want to be turned on when they want to be turned on. And when that doesn't happen, I think a lot of changes will be happening, and those will happen very quickly.
You know, Craig, I'm really surprised. In my own state, we've already closed down one power plant. The next one, our final one, is due to be decommissioned by 2025. And you take a look at the space of a nuclear power plant today. Much more efficient, very green, very reliable. We're going to have something like that, because I interviewed an author on electricity, and he basically said green doesn't work without nuclear, because wind and solar is too intermittent. As you just pointed out, some days the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow.
That's 100% accurate statement, and I think that's the biggest thing that a lot of folks don't seem to comprehend is just that particular fact. And I don't think anybody in this country or anybody in the G20 is going to accept intermittent power as a way forward for their economies, period. Like, I don't think that's going to be the answer. We could talk about putting batteries in and other things, but we're going to have to really sit down and understand the green aspects of battery power. And what do you do to dispose of those batteries? And what does it take to get some of those rare minerals out of the earth and the energy consumed to get that? And Jim, I just remind everybody, I'll just say this, it's going to take a lot of old energy to make all the new energy that people want. And we can't simply just sidestep that process and just magically overnight put in all these windmills without burning a lot of gas, oil, diesel, to get those things put in place. So we need to have a measured process. Take a look at what's happening in Europe and Germany specifically, right? They've gone very quickly to shutting down nuclear plants. They've had to actually come around and fire up their coal-fired power plants again because they don't have enough electrical capacity and prices have gone too high, and it's made it very difficult. Perhaps they're trying to raise costs of heating, driving, and everything else to try to slow down carbon emissions. Maybe that's one of the initiatives out there. Not really sure. It's not really what I do. I look at charts, and what I do see with charts is that coal prices are going up, oil prices are going up, nat gas are all going up. It's getting a lot more expensive. And there'll be a midterm election coming. And so I think there'll be some changes made if we see these prices get too far out of line. Because again, simple, simple stuff, Jim. People want their lights to turn on when they flip that little white switch for the lights to come on.
So given where we are right now, and given your year-end target, we're about 3.5% away from that. Craig, if you had to put money to work, where would you put it?
I think you got to come back to financials first and foremost. I think you also need to think that interest rates are probably going to be moving higher too. So that's going to be a little bit more of a headwind. But again, the financials should do well. There were a lot of reserves taken by the big banks during the downturn for COVID in 2020. And you can see from some of the results that are coming out so far, there's a fair amount of unwinding of some of those reserves, which is certainly helping earnings for those companies. I think you also have to continue to look at the energy sector. You also, I think, have to look at tech, because tech is also going to benefit as we continue to see this economy looking for increased ways to become more productive. I think technology is going to fit nicely into that too. There's going to be a little bit of handoff there, though, Jim, between technology and financials, depending on whether you're at growth versus value. But consumer, I think, is going to do well in this mix also, Jim. Just as a handful of areas that we should be thinking about.
So, Craig, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work at Piper Sandler, how could they do so?
Jim, they're welcome to shoot me out an email. They can send it to craig.johnson@psc.com. And I'm happy to put them on with friends and family list if they'd like to see more of our work.
Well, as we get closer to 4625, you will still be wearing the bullseye crown. So, Craig, once again, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Obviously, at this stage, there's a lot of supply side issues which are feeding into inflation. But my call was not associated with these real economy supply side factors. It was to do with the amount of money that had been created back in 2020 by a new form, a new structure of monetary policy, which involved government intervention with the commercial banks. The bad news is that there's usually quite a lag between the creation of money and inflation. So this is the early doors. This is the foothills of that inflation, because given the amount of money we created last year, inflation should go a bit higher from here, and it should continue for another year or two. And then, of course, there's the second question, which we'll no doubt come on to, is how much money will we be creating going forward? So there's a big lag. It maybe came a little bit quicker. I said it would happen. We'd get about 4% before the end of this year. And of course, it came a bit quicker than I thought, probably due to supply side effect. So the bad news is, I think the real impact of the monetary effect is only starting.
To listen to this full 40-minute interview with the noted financial historian Russell Napier, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium podcasts airing 3 days every week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Inflation is proving more persistent. Everybody was told it could be transitory, but it continues to march higher as oil crosses $80 a barrel. What does this mean for inflation, and how are the precious metals market reacting to it? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, you know, I wonder how much this market is being distorted by, for example, what the Fed is doing. We have inflation, official inflation, running at 5%. And you've got the 10-year note at roughly about 1.6%. So not only are you making less than inflation, but take out taxes and you're losing ground. Why haven't the metals market, in your opinion, responded to this new threat of inflation?
First of all, you could always use the word manipulation or management. I really don't want to start there, but obviously I just did. I think we take a step back and look maybe over the past year or so. If we go back to March 2020, we had the highest gold-silver ratio ever recorded in modern times. 125 to 1, some say 130 to 1, but you get the idea. Since that time till present, it actually was cut in half, which means that silver outperformed gold about 2-1. The point I want to make is this. After that big drop that was very short in duration, silver breached the $20 level, which was where it was held for about 8 years. So overcoming an 8-year, let's say, ceiling, we did get up to the 28 level. Now, as you suggest, Jim, that with all the new, you know, numbers and inflation, why isn't it going, you know, above 28 and we're stuck in the 22, 23, 24 range? And the answer is supply and demand. And I think one of the biggest factors is the bifurcation of the markets. And what I mean specifically is there is basically almost no correlation between the physical economy and the financial markets. As I've said in the past, there used to be almost a direct correlation between the economy and the financial sector. I mean, Charles Dow came up with the Dow theory, and at the time it was more than a theory. It was pretty darn accurate as far as the economic health of the average, the transportation, and the utilities, which were stalwarts even now, as far as how the actual physical economy is functioning. But we've lost that years ago with financial repression, keeping these interest rates, as you say, Jim, the 10-year at 1.6%, which has no reflection with reality other than the bond market must keep interest rates low or else the whole house of cards comes falling down because we have an inaccurate measure of the cost of money. Interest rates should be established by the market. They are not. They're established by basically Federal Reserve, which sets the Fed funds rates and others, but they have such a management ability now with the member banks that have the ability to securitize their offerings and put them out into the marketplace. It's really upsetting to someone like me, a student of the markets that knows how these markets could function now and they have not functioned properly for so long.
You know, Dave, you bring up an interesting point, the physical market versus the paper market. And we see that right now even with copper. Copper is heading into a major deficit. It's a key metal if you want to go green. Think of batteries. Think of charging stations. Think of all the things. And likewise with silver, when you talk about solar panels, wind turbines, and all the electronic devices we have, where you've got a deficit in copper, and yet copper's pulled back. So there is a definite difference between what the physical market is reacting to versus the paper markets. But, you know, Dave, as long as I've known you for the last couple of decades, that's always been the case, at least with silver. I can remember, gosh, when you introduced me to silver back in 2001, I was looking at this and I go, my God, this is an opportunity. And you remember this, Dave, you know, every time silver got up to $5, it got slammed, got down to $4. The shorts would reverse. They'd go long. Then they would go short again at $5. And it was like that for 3 or 4 years until it finally busted out. Do you see something like that happening in the metals market? In other words, one day we wake up and say, you know, we have some serious problems here and they're inflationary and money gravitates towards gold and silver as a safe haven. That's one question. The second question I'd like you to address is we've seen gold go from at the beginning of the new century is around 250, 300, got up to over 2000. Silver got up to 50 briefly in 2011. But Dave, silver was at 50 in 1980. So if you take, you know, 40 years on an inflation adjusted basis, silver should be a lot higher.
I will answer both questions. I'm going to digress back to the copper comment that you made. First of all, I agree. Secondly, you know, I certainly don't want to come across like a big conspiracy theorist. And it's, of course, it's two words that are often used to basically make sure that no one listens to whoever has something to say once those monikers are put out in front of whatever they have to suggest. But if you look at copper, we're at the about $4.30, and we're below the 200-day moving average, no, slightly above the 200-day average, and just basically at the 50-day moving average, very close. The reason I brought up the long chart is because I want to see what it looks like while the, I will say, it potentially could be painting the tape, because copper, from a technical perspective, looks like a really large head and shoulders formation. It looks like the right shoulder is being developed as we speak. And as we both know, so much of the trading in the financial markets, particularly in the futures markets before it went to the stock market, was done on algorithms. It's very simple, not simple, but isn't all that difficult to price set in the futures markets, because there's so leveraged and certain levels actually will command more selling and that type of thing because of margin calls and on and on. So I want to make that comment about copper. Fundamentally, it's couldn't be more of a bright picture. Technically, it's not lining up with that, which goes back to harp on the point. Why doesn't the financial system reflect the economic reality? Why isn't the economy that's shorting, that's, you know, needs copper, needs it in higher quantities, why isn't that reflected financially? And I'll leave the listener to make up their own mind. Coming to the, will gold and silver break out? Yes, they will. When is always the big question. And the answers, I really don't know. I've kind of backed off on, you know, my projections, although I did say I thought silver could hit 30 by the end of the year. And I said that back in, you know, February, March, we were hitting 28. In fact, we almost touched 30 in the aftermarket. And so I was pretty confident of that call. I'm not so sure anymore. What I do know is that the price of silver, the price of gold, the price of copper and soybean meal, for that matter, is a derivatives price. You are finding what the price for a contract is. That's what you're establishing. Now, to be fair, in most instances, that contract price can be, you could take the warrant off and you could take delivery of silver, for example, or soybean oil, meal for that matter. But that's only about 1% of the time. So what other market do you know of in the economic system where there's a price set that's basically a piece of paper versus what you would pay in the store? Not many, but that's how the whole system is set up. So I look for a major breakout above 30 in silver, and it could happen early next year. In fact, I still think it will. And once we get there, there's very little resistance to 50. And then that goes to the second question, why is silver, you know, not above, you know, it's 1980 high, especially on an inflation-adjusted basis. And the answer is, again, to sound conspiratorial, but silver is probably the most imperative commodity outside of oil for the well-being of the planet. Not only is it green, but everything that we do today requires electricity. These little boxes that we carry around with us that are called smart all require a great deal of silver relative to what we would use in, say, the 1880s, where it would only be for monetary purposes. So silver's been demonetized, and I think deliberately, for a very long time. I did a lecture series about 2 years ago called What If Silver Were Treated Like Gold? And the whole premise of that is, what if silver was thought of as a monetary asset rather than an industrial commodity? And the answer is, for over 4,500 years, the gold-silver ratio never got above 20. Which means it was 20 or below, which if you use that ratio now with gold, I don't know what it is today, Jim, but say 1800, you're looking at a 20-to-1 ratio, you'd be looking at $90 silver. And that is how it was for, remember, 4,500 years. So silver's obviously got a much more impactful value when it's valued as a monetary asset. Now, we have seen, remarkably, some people that have woken up to the silver story, particularly at the Davos meeting in January 2020, when Scott Meiner talked about silver being his number one go-to investment. And it also so happens that a fact has been established of the amount of ETP purchases in 2020 of 320 million ounces. Unprecedented. We never had that kind of move into physical silver at any time in the last 50 years, other than a Warren Buffett but that was about one third of the amount that I just mentioned. So there's someone out there that has patience. There are some strong hands, and the market is far, far tighter than the price would suggest. And it wouldn't take a lot of people waking up to the silver story. And the last thing I'll comment on is because silver is bulky relative to gold, it really isn't bulky relative to other assets, but most people don't think of it that way. A lot of silver is in stored vaults. And there's been a lot of, let's say, consternation on the internet regarding allocated versus unallocated storage. A lot of people, particularly from this gentleman called John Adams out of Australia, has suggested that people look at what they hold, and if it is unallocated, to move it to allocated. I'd go one step beyond that. When Morgan Stanley was taken to court and lost a court case, they had sold a fairly significant amount of physical silver on the books and were charging storage for it. One of the, let's say, people, how do I phrase this? There was someone that questioned their practices, went to court, and during the discovery process revealed that not only had Morgan Stanley not bought any silver whatsoever at all, but they didn't even have a vault to store it in. And yet they had charged for the silver and they had charged for the storage of the silver. And there was an article that came shortly after there was a fine paid. No one went to jail. They weren't banned from trading silver anymore, which is what I would have done, but I digress. But what's interesting, this article in CoinWorld said that Morgan Stanley had suggested that it was standard practice in the industry to operate the metals market that way. That's a mouthful. Now, I could cite the article. I can show you the article. I'm not making this up. What I am suggesting is the consideration of people that have stored metal to verify it. And that's very difficult to do. So I think what I've said way back in 2001, when we talked about silver at $5, and I said, and now I'm repeating from almost two decades ago, if I were to stand in the call box at the Rose Bowl, and I had everyone that owned silver on one side of the 50-yard line put their silver up. And on the other side of the 50-yard line, everyone that owned a certificate for physical silver on the other side, that's a huge mismatch. They would not match. And that is one of the problems in the silver market, is there's no accountability in the most strict sense that we can really point the finger at, oh, so-and-so isn't doing what they're saying they're doing. Obviously, the Morgan Stanley example, I can prove to you. I don't think I need to, but it's not about Morgan Stanley. It's about how the metals market works at large. And this is significant. And it goes all the way back to the goldsmiths when they put out certificates for the amount of gold that they were warehousing and discovered that only about 10% of the people ever came back for the physical gold. The other 90% were happy just to push the certificates around.
You know, it's amazing, Dave, that you mentioned that, because the Goldman Sachs just put out a report on the copper market, and they're talking about, you know, don't watch the futures market. They're saying watch the inventory levels. And it's kind of like that with oil. We saw oil inventories drop in 4 months. They're down about 40%. And here we are talking about oil. A West Texas Intermediate, over $80. Let me ask you this. What role do you think cryptocurrencies have played in taking some of the, I guess, demand for gold? And the reason I mention this, Dave, if we take a look at the 00 decade, a time when the mining companies were really mismanaging themselves, they were over-diluting, overpaying, and we came out with these ETFs, GLD, SLV, and all of a sudden, these bullion ETFs began to compete with the miners and took away some of the, I guess, the upside potential of the mining stocks, and rightfully so, because the executives that ran these companies were doing a terrible job. But what about cryptos today versus, let's say, the metals market? How much money has been siphoned off the precious metals market and found its way in cryptos?
A great deal more than I initially suggested. When they first came out, I have, you know, anecdotal evidence from a few of the coin dealers that I know on a first name basis that gave me these stories about guys driving in with, you know, monster boxes of Maples or Eagles and dropping them off for cash and then going right into Bitcoin. And obviously that proves the point that there's been some, you know, metals people that have moved into cryptocurrencies, and not specifically Bitcoin, but obviously that's kind of the stalwart. What I've discovered over the last couple of years is that that flow was a lot greater than I anticipated or that I thought initially. And what's disheartening to me, of course, being an honest money and, you know, person, I'm obviously biased, but most everyone in the my children's age group, the millennials or younger, are fascinated with everything digital, everything electronic, everything comes off their phone. Their phone is their life practically. And they have very little understanding of monetary history, what happens in markets, why a digit on a screen is not necessarily the value in physical economy, but is merely a financial representation of something that may not be accurate, but they don't know that. And I think there is this, what others have called this mother nature of the financial system, or maybe the truth will out. And there is a day of reckoning, and it's not because I'm a doomer. I am a realist. I am about as solid as you get. I mean, my engineering background taught me to think logically and always question my premises. Do I get it right 100% of the time? No, I don't. But when I get better data and more information, I'll change my opinion. My opinions change on the cryptos. They have sucked a lot of money that would have gone into the precious metals. And I personally am trying to figure out some methodology that can be used just to not push people into metals, but let them question their balance. And if you're, a crypto millionaire today, you might be a crypto non-millionaire tomorrow. And if you have something of substance as a hedge to everything, I mean, the metals are a hedge to almost everything. And yet that word, as long as I've preached it, has fallen on deaf ears for the most part.
So, Dave, given where the metals market is now, and as we take a look at inflation, I've been a proponent over the last probably year or so that this is not a transitory thing. In fact, I was talking about an energy crisis last March, and here we are. We're about ready. In some parts of California, we're over $6 gasoline, and we're close to $5 every place else. Where would you be putting money? I mean, would you buy metals here and just tuck it aside and just have the patience to see it through?
Well, I would. I mean, first of all, as I said, it's a hedge against everything. And if you go into the future, you know, and of course, this is a very fuzzy crystal ball, but I interviewed on my mastermind series a gentleman named Matt Watson. Matt was somebody that I learned about from the Silver Institute because I still have a fairly strong relationship with them. And Matt's an independent researcher, and he does everything on the industrial side of many metals, not just silver. So we had a very long talk, and then we did the mastermind. And what he pointed out was that the current trend, of course, it's not a linear projection. It's, you know, least squares. It's a curve fit. It's a projection of trends that will accelerate in the future, like copper, the reason why, EVs. So anyway, it's a pretty well thought out analysis, is my point. He suggested that the amount of silver used in industry will be 80% of the entire market by 2030, which is, you know, 9 years away. He also suggested that some of these people that suggest $200 silver, remember, I'm one of those lightweights that has only said 100, are correct, or let me restate that, could be correct. And he believes that they will be correct. So there, and lastly, he just did an update with Kitco that I listened to. And the announcer asked him, well, how long have we got to go? And Matt cited that the USGS, United States Geological Survey, said we have about 20 years worth of silver left on the planet. Now, of course, there's a big asterisk to that statement. And that is, if silver is at 25, there's only so much that's economic. But There is, a lot of uneconomic silver that would become economic if silver were at 100 or 200 an ounce. But what's interesting is the depletion of the silver as far as the grade is concerned. Now, I just finished the Silver Symposium in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, a week and a half ago. And Jeff Christian, who's always been invited every time because he's got more of an establishment viewpoint than most of the silver community. And he pointed out that that was kind of a misnomer, that was because mines are high grading certain areas when the price is low. And then when prices are high, they go to lower grade. There is some truth in that. More in the gold sector than the silver sector, but there is some truth in the silver sector. But if you do not discount high grading or low grading and just look at a plot of grade over time, regardless of economic conditions or prices. So in other words, you take the price out of the graph and only look at grade, it is diminishing substantially over time, Jim. So are we running out of silver? No, but if you are any age, but if you're 30 or 40 and you want to build some legacy for your kids or your grandkids, you want to make sure they go to the best school wherever over in the future, depending on what the heck's going on in the future. My point is that's a legacy investment. I always thought of gold as a legacy investment, and I'm not going to discount what Jim Rickard says and many analysts that are pretty bright. But what I am saying, being a silver specialist, that I think those roles could change over the next couple of decades. That's my point.
Well, listen, Dave, as we close, if people like to find out about the Morgan Report, tell them how they could do so.
The easiest is just to go to the main landing page, themorganreport.com. It's a bit of a sales page. Just get on the free list. Just give me a first name and an email. It's a double opt-in, which means you're going to have to verify it's really you and you need to make up some email. And you're there. So everything I do in the public domain, and I also do a weekly podcast. I try to keep it about 15 minutes. I talk about the overall economic situation from my perspective. I usually put up some graphics or whatever. And then I usually end with about 5 minutes on the precious metals markets with some comments that hopefully will help guide you through this very interesting time frame that we now have.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Have a great rest of the year and happy holidays.
The peak of electricity demand happens between 4 and 9 o'clock at night. And the solar panels don't make any electricity during those hours. And so what happens is the natural gas fired system, the gas turbines, all spin up, mid-afternoon to produce the power when it's needed. And the solar panels don't make any power. And so it's like city driving versus highway driving in that every day those turbines are turned down, they're idled down at lunch when the solar is making a lot of electricity, and then they throttle them up and ramp them up for the end of the day. And when they do that, turns out they emit a lot more carbon dioxide because it's like city driving, versus highway driving. They're just less efficient. So it turns out in California, as California has added wind and solar onto the grid and has hit, a mid 20% market share, the actual emissions from the electricity sector have fallen a lot less than they expected because of this phenomena.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Welcome everyone to this week's Big Picture. Today we're going to discuss America's coming energy crisis and the return of high inflation. And starting last year after the COVID crisis initially hit, two major themes of our show and certainly on our Big Picture segments have been how we are sowing the seeds for two things. The first is, of course, an energy crisis due to a sustained undersupply of oil and gas, and two, much higher inflation due to large amounts of spending into the economy, which increases aggregate demand, in the face of widespread closures and lockdowns, which, of course, decreases supply. And although the supply chain issues are likely to get resolved over time, as we've been seeing, the larger inflationary trend will prove to be non-transitory and persistent, and very likely to be with us for the remainder of this decade. Now, this is not only something that, Jim, you have been arguing, but also one of the leading financial historians, Russell Napier, just reiterated this outlook on Insider this week. So, Jim, With those two major themes that we've been developing since last year, a coming energy crisis, which we see underway right now, and the return of high inflation, if you wouldn't mind, let's kick things off with what you are seeing on the energy front, which of course is in the headlines and in the news almost on a daily basis now.
You know, Chris, I would say probably the biggest factor that was leading me to this conclusion is when you think about it, oil companies produce energy every single day. They're pumping out barrels of oil, volumes of natural gas. But, you know, they have to go out and replace what they find. And over the last decade, with falling oil prices, these oil companies have been cutting back in a major way their energy investments. In fact, the IEA has been talking about the trillions of dollars that are going to have to be invested just to keep oil levels at the current level, because we have something called depletion. And a lot of the major oil fields in the world have been in decline. You know, one of the biggest oil fields was Canarel in Mexico. That is, you know, out of production. You've got Garwar in Saudi Arabia. There's question how much that's producing. And just the fact that we're getting into shale is telling you that it's a diminishing type return. So we were seeing a lack of investment. And then on top of that, a lot of the Wall Street firms were looking at energy, and especially when it came to fracking, which helped increase U.S. oil production from a little over 5 million barrels a day. Before COVID, Chris, we got up to, I think, what was the figure, 12 or 13 million barrels, and we became the number one producer. So all of these things, you know, we saw all this shale revolution, but these shale companies weren't making money. So Wall Street basically said, you know, we're tired of pumping money into energy companies and we're getting nothing in return. So now you have financial discipline with the oil companies. They're not spending much on expenditures. They're buying back stock. They're paying out dividends. But the key thing here was a lack of energy investment. And then a new factor that has come in with ESG, which has been embraced on Wall Street, you've got activist fund managers that are going on the boards of energy companies. I can think of Exxon, and they're wanting these companies to divest themselves of their energy assets. It's happening with the big energy companies in Europe, whether it's Royal Dutch by a Brussels court, or it's British Petroleum. And then here in the U.S., you've got pressure on Exxon and some of the other companies. So lack of energy investment, Wall Street urging companies to divest, and then on top of that, now recently, government mandates and power plant closures. So if you take a look at, you know, the Biden administration got rid of Keystone, the governor of Michigan is getting rid of a pipeline, and that's just going to raise the cost of energy. It's more efficient. It's environmentally safer to transfer oil on a pipeline versus try to put those same barrels of oil on a train or a truck. It's just simply more expensive. And so you add lack of investment, you add Wall Street ESG investing and divesting. I mean, you heard Craig Johnson, it's hard to get a portfolio manager to look at oil stocks. About the only guy that's done that is Warren Buffett. He bought 50 million shares of Chevron. But, and also the government mandates and the power plant closures. And it's no wonder, Chris, we're seeing the kind of oil prices that we're seeing now. As the economies recover, demand comes back. Shortly by next year, if the economy doesn't go into recession, we could be at $100 oil, as Craig was talking about.
Yeah, and Jim, the Department of Energy now estimates that heating costs for households are going to be 30% higher this winter. So when you're talking about, you know, the lack of investment that has gone into the energy space and how this was leading up to a sustained period of undersupply, which we're facing right now, and higher prices, this is something that you warned about earlier this year. We're starting to feel the pinch of that with higher gasoline prices, higher natural gas prices, and higher oil prices. And unfortunately, all this goes to show that the energy transition, if forced too quickly, upon the global economy is leading to a number of dislocations. And that's kind of what we're seeing take place right now. And something, again, that you have been discussing over and over again.
Yeah, the problem with energy transitions is they take several decades to complete. And this idea that we're going to be all green in 10 years, Chris, is not going to work. And, you know, you think about when we went from horses and buggies to automobiles, that took nearly two decades. You had the car manufacturers, you had the tire companies, you had to have gas stations, you had to have highways. So it took several decades to do that. The same is going to be with green. You just can't give these mandates, as these governors and presidents are apt to do, and just say, all right, by 2030 or by 2035, you can't drive gasoline cars. I know in California, the governor just ruled out gas lawnmowers, leaf blowers, generators. And also, I think it's 2030. You're not going to have diesel trucks in this state if you want to bring in goods. By 2035, you won't be able to sell gasoline cars. Well, Chris, if we're all going to go to green cars, we're going to have EVs. That means at night, your car is going to be in your garage consuming energy. And then, as anybody that lives in California, we're always having brownouts. Our grid is not structured to handle present demand. God knows what it's going to be if we go completely green. So at the same time that these politicians are mandating these green new policies, they're also shutting down power plants. California had two nuclear power plants. We shut down San Onofre. By 2025, Diablo Canyon will be shut down. That'll be another loss of 10% of the state's electricity. I mean, we're buying power from nuclear plants in Arizona. We're also shutting down our coal plants. We're shutting down nuclear power plants. New York is shutting down its nuclear power plants. We're shutting down some of the natural gas plants. And then at the same time, if you take a look at the current policies that are working their way through Washington, we're going to remove a lot of the incentives that the energy companies get. So as Goldman's talking about, we're moving from recovery to scarcity, which is what we're seeing now. So the only way you get rid of scarcity in high prices is supply shortages can only be solved by demand destruction. And what I expect to see as we climb to $90 and $100 a barrel, and we start paying $5, $6, we're already at $5 and $6 in California. As Craig talked about, every recession that we have seen has been accompanied by rising interest rates and rising energy prices. Go back to 1981, go back to 1991, go back to 2001, 2008. The only recession that didn't happen was that little brief recession because of shutdowns in 2020. So, Chris, we're heading in that direction. And a lot of our grid throughout this country, not just California, California is going to be an energy basket case. But we're mandating this conversion to clean energy. And yet at the same time, we're shutting down the sources that are going to provide that electricity. So, you know, politicians are not connecting the dots and saying, wait a minute, if we're going to require everybody have electric vehicles and we're going clean, we better have a dependable source of power. And when we interviewed Robert Bryce on his new book on electricity, he said, green does not work without nuclear. So you think about how much acreage a solar farm takes to provide power, or let's say windmills. You compare that to the profile of a nuclear power plant. A nuclear power plant is more reliable, it's more efficient, it's green, and it doesn't take the environmental space that wind and solar do. So, you know, if we keep going in this direction as we're doing here in California, as we're doing in New York, as we're doing in Michigan, we're going to be in a full-blown energy crisis, as we're now seeing in Europe. Coming up next is going to be the U.S.
So, Jim, let's segue into our belief that we're going to see persistent inflation now for, as you explained, this year, likely the remainder of this decade. And this was something that Russell Napier also said this week on FS Insider. when we had spoken with you last time, I believe you said that you expect this to last up to a decade, if not more. Is that still your thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason for that is I believe this is a deliberate policy. It isn't accidental. And all policies have a goal. And the goal of this policy is to bring debt to GDP ratios to levels which are not dangerous, levels where economic contractions don't trigger financial crises. And that level is closer to 200% of GDP than 300% of GDP. So the reason for picking that 10 to 15 years is I think that's how long it might take. If inflation is 4 to 6 and nominal growth is closer to 8 to 10, well, you put those two things together and you might be able to achieve it within 10 to 15 years.
You know, we did a whole segment on inflation, Chris, and I talked about three major macro factors: demographics, aging population, fewer younger workers, monopolies as industry after industry consolidates, and then also reverse globalization. So those are some of the bigger macro factors. But the other thing that we're seeing right now, and why we didn't see inflation, I've talked about this in the past after the financial crisis, the Fed printed money, but most of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed, and banks weren't loaning out money. They were repairing their balance sheet. So a lot of credit wasn't being pushed into the system. Contrast that today, beginning with Trump and now accelerating under Biden, the government is basically going fiscally insane. I mean, the government's budget was $6 trillion for 2020. Because of COVID, they spent an additional $3 trillion, so it was $9 trillion. Chris, we've already passed $9 trillion for 2021. The fiscal year ended in September. And so now they're talking about, we passed a supplemental bill at the beginning of the year that was $1.9 trillion. They're talking about $1.2 trillion for infrastructure. And then they're scaling back the $3.5 trillion bill for reconciliation. That's not going to fly. I don't know what the number is going to be. $2 trillion, $2.5 trillion, or $1.5 trillion. Who knows what it is? But the government is pushing more money into the system, directly into the economy, and the Fed is just simply going out and printing money. And there's this theory going on among political elites, and this goes on both sides of the party, because remember, we ran trillion-dollar deficits under Trump, is that, well, if you can print the money in your own currency, you don't need to worry about it. The other thing, unemployment benefits, which are destroying the work incentive. Everywhere you look, I don't care, it's restaurants, it's gyms, it's manufacturing, a shortage of workers. And then also the other thing that we're going to see is with these vaccine mandates creating further work shortages. We're seeing healthcare workers basically step down and they're losing their jobs because they don't want to get the vaccine. That should tell you something. You also have policemen, our first responders. You've got firefighters. And of course, last weekend, we had pilots and workers for Southwest Airlines. Basically, it was a work stoppage. The other thing, too, is we're seeing these supply disruptions with the ports backed up with ships. They don't have the workers at the port. They don't have the drivers. And we're seeing something that we haven't seen in a while. A lot of the big box stores, normally when you see these container ships, these big, large cargo ships carry about 20,000 containers. Well, now stores like Target, Walmart, Costco are chartering small ships. And these small ships only basically can hold 1,000 to maybe 2,000 containers. And right now, just to give you an idea, and this is going to feed through the system, last year, a 40-foot container cost $5,000 to ship across the ocean. Fast forward to where we are today, that same 40-foot container cost $16,750. Basically, more than a threefold increase. And on top of that, instead of taking 40 days, it's now taking 80 days to transport those goods. So, and then on top of that, you throw fiscal policy, which is just going insane. It's pouring gasoline on the fire. To give you an example, they just announced, and this is good news if you're retired, Social Security increases for 2022 are going to be close to 6%. Chris, that's the highest increase in Social Security benefits in four decades. So what is that telling you? It's telling you a lot of pipeline inflation, whether it's energy, work stoppages, a shortage of workers, unable to get goods to port and unload them. All of this stuff is feeding through the system.
So it sounds like, and this is something that we've also been hammering on now for at least a few months, if not more, but that investors should be preparing for a stagflationary investment environment.
Yeah, we're already seeing that now. Third quarter GDP is probably going to be in the neighborhood of 2.5 to 3. We're seeing lower GDP for the fourth quarter. So economic growth is slowing. Add, Chris, higher energy prices, the possibility of higher taxes, and then all this embedded inflation that we have in the pipeline, whether it's the supply chain, whether it's oil prices, whether it's the cost of shipping goods, labor wages falling behind. And then we're seeing a rise in commodity prices. I'm a sailor, and a friend of mine is looking at buying a boat. And Chris, just in the last year, the price of boats have gone up over 20%. So I don't care if it's cars, RVs, boats, all these kind of items are going up. And then we also have the possibility right now that they could put crippling taxes with this new legislation. So higher oil prices, higher interest rates, the Fed cutting bad on QE, higher wage prices, and then higher taxes. I'm of the view, I don't think the Fed realistically is going to be able to raise interest rates. We're approaching $30 trillion in debt. We could be running $3 trillion deficits. We could be at $40 trillion here in the next 2 or 3 years. At this level, every 1% increase, if interest rates were to go up from 2% to 3% for the government, that would actually put interest cost at almost $1 trillion. So there's just simply too much debt at all levels of society, whether you're looking at government debt, corporate debt, or individual debt. So in our view, be prepared for a stagflation, very much like what we saw in the 70s under Jimmy Carter.
So not just stagflation, but also financial repression, right? Keeping rates low with inflation levels running hotter in order to reduce the value of outstanding debts. This punishes savers, incentivizes debtors. And yeah, I got to read this to you, Jim. This was something that I saw posted just this week, which I thought was insightful, to say the least. And it was titled "The Fed's 5 Stages of Denial on Inflation." But I would say that this expands to more than just the Fed. We should also apply this just in terms of the consensus view and also the government response. Number one, when it comes to inflation, the first response will be inflation is transitory. So we've already heard that. After it becomes very clear to everyone that that is no longer true, the next rationalization will be, well, inflation is transitory, but it's going to last a little bit longer than we thought. So that's where we're at now. That's the most recent communication by Powell at the Fed. The next stage, which we're probably going to see either maybe in their next speech or in 2022, is, okay, inflation is persistent, but we have the tools to deal with it. Then after that, once that no longer proves true, the next communication will be, actually, the trade-offs of a higher inflation are worth it. Maybe we don't have the tools to deal with it, but the trade-offs are beneficial. Then after that, the fifth and final will be price controls and targeted taxation measures, implementing essentially modern monetary theory, where you deal with out-of-control inflation in light of the spending that is taking place with targeted taxation and just outright price control. So that would be the fifth and final stage that we would get to. And perhaps that's going to be a 2022 or maybe a 2023 story.
Oh, I think by the end of 2022, and eventually that's what they'll do. They did it in the 70s, price controls. It didn't work. Ronald Reagan reversed those. We'll try them again. And it still won't work. It'll just create nothing but shortages. So that's why, folks, we're going to do a show on emergency preparedness. Don't laugh. Remember what it was like trying to get meat, toilet paper last year? Well, take a look at what you're going to be facing when it comes to Christmas this year.
Let's boil this down. Investment implications. What are some of the things that you're telling investors right now?
Avoid long-term dated bonds. So if you're in a bond fund, make sure it's short-term. We like TIPS, which are Treasury inflation-protected securities. I think, Chris, it's a theme that we're developing and we're investing for this commodity bull market of a lifetime because we're going from basically to scarcities. So, you know, we're in oil. We started buying oil last summer, and I increased it this summer. Copper, silver, base metals, agriculture. And then because of financial repression, you know, the Fed's going to keep the lid on interest rates because the deficits and the debt is so large. So high dividend paying blue chips for income. If you take a look at interest rates and dividends, when we came out of the Great Depression, stocks were considered risky. So stock dividends were higher than bond yields. Fast forward to where we are today, I can get better yields for income that go up each year in stocks versus bonds. So our favorite investment, commodities, high dividend paying blue chip stocks, TIPS, and basically I would avoid long dated bonds.
As always, if you want to contact us and speak with any of our financial advisors, you can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We'd like to thank you for joining us here on Financial Sense. In the meantime, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.